So then, if Halloween as we know it today isn't necessarily a continuation of Samhain, then where does it find its origins? The answer, surprisingly, is with Old Mother Church. Halloween was never a pagan festival. It has always been distinctly Christian. Welcome to The Narnian. I'm your host, Josh Robinson, and on today's edition, I'm going to be reading an essay of mine that I just released on my Substack called Christians and Halloween, The Lordship of Christ Over the Seasons. You can actually find this in my book, Reenchanting Time, How the Lordship of Christ Changes Timekeeping, as an appendix at the end of the book. So if you're interested in that, that's available on Amazon for you to pick up. So we'll go ahead and dive right into it. Introduction. Is Halloween just a continuation of Samhain? Are Christians accidental pagans by participating in things such as trick-or-treating and dressing in costumes? Should Christians partake in celebrating Halloween? These types of questions are questions that I seem to be receiving more the longer that I'm in ministry. Usually around this time every year, I share a short article called Concerning Halloween by James B. Jordan. I have always appreciated Jordan's brief, reasoned defense of why Christians can consider celebrating Halloween. However, this year, I wanted to take a stab, get it, at writing my own that is a little more contextual to the questions and the objections that I've received. I also want to engage with some of the more recent things that I've come across over the years as well. Samhain. So to begin, we must answer the question, is Halloween just a continuation of the pagan harvest festival Samhain? That's pronounced Samhain, not Samhain. The short answer is no. Samhain is an ancient festival with Celtic origins that marked the end of the harvest year and welcome in the dark half of the year. It has traditionally been celebrated from October 31st to November 1st. The ancient Celts believed that during this season, the point or the veil between the seen and the unseen realms became thin. Because of this thinning, this meant that the spirits could easily cross between the realms and could enter into our world. For this reason, the Celts would offer up food and drinks to the spirits, and occasionally an animal was sacrificed to appease them as well. It was also believed that the souls of the departed were believed to visit their homes seeking hospitality. In some cases, a place setting of food and drink was put on the dining table in anticipation for the visit. While it is clear that Samhain and Halloween share at least some connection points, such as dates, an emphasis on disguises or costumes, and harvest decoration, that's about all they have in common. No one celebrating Halloween is celebrating for the purpose of welcoming in the dark half of the year, nor are they making sacrifices to appease spirits because of the metaphysical belief that the veil between the seen and the unseen realms is thin. All Saints Hallows Eve. So then, if Halloween as we know it today isn't necessarily a continuation of Samhain, then where does it find its origins? The answer, surprisingly, is with Old Mother Church. Halloween was never a pagan festival. It has always been distinctly Christian. Indeed, even the name Halloween is a contraction of All Saints Hallows Eve, which was the night before All Saints Day. Stephen Wedgeworth brilliantly notes this in further detail in his essay, Halloween, Its Creation and Recreation. He writes, Halloween, as its name should make clear, has a distinctively Christian genealogy. Nicholas Rogers, in his book Halloween, From Pagan Ritual to Party Night, a title more sensational than its text, explains, Samhain did not offer much in way of actual ritual practices, Most of these developed in conjunction with the medieval holy days of All Souls and All Saints Day. The name Halloween is, as is well known, a contraction of All Hallows Eve, the night before All Saints Day. But we have to take into account the series of All Hallows Eve, All Saints Day, and All Souls Day to form the entire picture. Each of these days, in slightly different ways, celebrated the Christian departed and established the memorialization of the dead as a key part of Halloween. So not only are Samhain and Halloween different in terms of origins, Samhain being of pagan origins and Halloween being of ecclesiastical origins, but also the intention behind the practices of these days is different as well. Again, while it's clear that Samhain and Halloween share at least some connection points, such as dates and emphasis on disguises and costumes and harvest decoration, the intent behind the practices is entirely different, and that's important. The intention is always important. James Jordan, in his essay concerning Halloween, expands on the intentions behind the practices of the Christian holiday of Halloween. He writes, "The biblical day begins in the preceding evening, and thus in the church calendar, the eve of a day is the actual beginning of the festive day. Christmas Eve is most familiar to us, but there is also the vigil of Holy Saturday that precedes Easter morn. Similarly, All Saints Eve precedes All Saints Day. The concept, as dramatized in Christian custom, is quite simple. On October the 31st, the demonic realm tries one last time to achieve victory, but is banished by the joy of the kingdom. What is the means by which the demonic realm is vanquished? In a word, mockery. Satan's great sin and our great sin is pride. Thus, to drive Satan from us, we ridicule him. This is why the custom arose of portraying Satan in a ridiculous red suit with horns and a tail. Nobody thinks that the devil really looks like this. The Bible teaches that he is a fallen arch-cherub. Rather, the idea is to ridicule him because he has lost the battle with Jesus and he no longer has power over us. The tradition of mocking Satan and defeating him through joy and laughter plays a large role in Ray Bradbury's classic novel, Something Wicked Comes This Way, which is a Halloween novel. The gargoyles that were placed on the churches of old had the same meaning. They symbolized the church ridiculing the enemy. They stick out their tongues and make faces at those who would assault the church. Gargoyles are not demonic. They are believers ridiculing the defeated demonic army. Thus, the defeat of evil and of the demonic powers is associated with Halloween. For this reason, Martin Luther posted his 95 challenges to the wicked practices of the church to the bulletin board on the door of the Wittenberg Chapel on Halloween. He picked his day with care, and ever since, Halloween has also been Reformation Day. In a similar way, on All Hallows Eve, the custom arose of mocking the demonic realm by dressing children in costumes, because the power of Satan has been broken once and for all, and our children could mock him by dressing up like ghosts, goblins, and witches. The fact that we can dress our children this way shows our supreme confidence in the utter defeat of Satan by Jesus Christ. Once one begins to understand the origins of Halloween, it becomes quite clear that there's nothing sinister happening here. Subversion? Sure. Seeking to view the seasons in light of the lordship of Christ? Absolutely. But accidental paganism? Not a chance. These things are two entirely different beasts, with two entirely different purposes, and two entirely different origin stories. The lordship of Christ over the seasons. Now at this point I want to anticipate some arguments that I'm likely to receive and offer some counterarguments. A first argument that I've encountered is that it's okay for God to mock his enemies, but it's unbiblical for Christians to mock Satan. Jude 1:8 is a proof text for this position. That text says this, "Despite that, in the same way also these men, because of their dreams, defile the flesh and reject authority and blaspheme majestic beings." But Michael, the archangel, when he argued with the devil, disputing concerning the body of Moses, did not dare to pronounce a blasphemous judgment, but said, "The Lord rebuke you." But these persons blaspheme all they do not understand, and all that they understand by instinct, like the irrational animals. By these things, they are being destroyed. From this proof text, it is argued that Michael the archangel did not pronounce a blasphemous judgment against Satan, because doing so would be blaspheming majestic, some translations say glorious, beings. Rather than rendering a blasphemous judgment, he said, "The Lord rebuke you." However, the problem is that this argument is a misunderstanding of the kind of mockery that is taking place at Halloween. We do not render mockery as autonomous beings apart from God. That would be blasphemous in that it would put us in the position of God. It would be a denial of the creator-creation distinction, and it would also be blaspheming majestic beings, as Jude says. The mockery that occurs at Halloween is a mockery that is rooted in our union with Christ. See Romans 5:1-5. He has disarmed the rulers and the principalities, and he has put them to open shame, triumphing over them. Colossians 1:15-23. Because of our union with him, we are not participating in an autonomous mockery, but a covenantal mockery that is united to Christ. We are essentially saying the same thing that the archangel Michael said in this text, "The Lord rebuke you." The second argument offered, and the most common objection to Christians celebrating Halloween, is that we should have nothing to do with anything that may have pagan overtones or connections to horror and things of that sort. However, there's various problems with this argument as well. The problem with this argument is that it seeks to abandon things to the kingdom of darkness. It gives too much ground to the enemy. This is not the way that Christianity has historically functioned. Because of Christ's lordship over everything, Christians have always sought to bring all things under his feet. Even pagan thought, at times, if it could be redeemed. The way that Christianity has historically done this is through its paradigm of bless, baptize, or burn. In practice, when Christianity encountered pagan thought that was true, it blessed it and accepted it, for all truth is God's truth. When it encountered pagan thought that could be redeemed and used to extend the lordship of Christ, it baptized it and then accepted it. But when it encountered pagan thought that could not be blessed or redeemed, it burned it and did not accept it. Commenting further on this paradigm in his book, Back to Virtue, Dr. Peter Kraft writes, "From the beginning, there were three different attitudes on the part of Christians to the pagan world in general. The first was uncritical synthesis. The second was critical synthesis. The third was criticism and anti-synthesis. Christian thinkers accepted either one, all, or two, some, or three, none of the Greek ideals. The greatest and mainstream Christians, like Augustine and Aquinas, took the second way, which was critical synthesis." An example that I'll point out here can be found in the Apostle Paul addressing the Areopagus at Mars Hill in Acts 17:22-34. In this scene, Paul makes his way to the Areopagus. He stands in their midst and begins to preach to the men of Athens. Paul says as he was passing through, considering their objects of worship, that he found an altar with the inscription, "To an unknown God." Paul then took the category of the unknown God, baptized it, and proceeded to tell them that the one whom they were worshiping without knowing was actually the true God, the Lord of heaven and earth, the God of Israel. Then he critically synthesizes and quotes a semi-mythical poet, Epimenides, and a Stoic philosopher named Cleanthes, to drive his points home even further. Christ is not Lord only over the Hebrews, but the Greeks too. It's just like their own poet said, "In him we live and move and have our being, and we are his offspring." A third problem with this argument is that engaging with things that may have pagan connections does not make one an accidental pagan. This is just plain old superstition. Let's say for the sake of argument that Halloween is pagan, and it's not, as I've already demonstrated here. But even if it were, one cannot accidentally become a pagan any more than one can accidentally become a Christian. Things just don't work that way. As I said above, intentions matter. I hope after all these examples that it's clear that if Christians should have nothing to do with anything that may have pagan overtones or connections, then Paul's sermon at the Areopagus would not exist. But it does exist, and it's because Christians over the centuries have taken the call to extending the lordship of Christ seriously. This is a vocation we must pick back up. The crown rights of King Jesus must be proclaimed over every area of life, even the seasons. And for these reasons, Christians can feel confident in baptizing pagan ideas and concepts they come across for the purpose of extending Christ's lordship over every area of life. Conclusion. So then, that leaves us with the question, should Christians celebrate Halloween? Personally, I have no issues celebrating Halloween. Not only do I believe that it's a practical and effective way extending the lordship of Christ over the seasons, but I also believe that it's a great way to live a life that's on mission. Halloween is one of the last communal holidays that we have in our culture. It's not often that folks from the neighborhood come to our doors anymore, so we view it as an opportunity to model gospel hospitality and to ask the question, do you know why we're celebrating this as Christians? This question leads us right to the heart of the gospel message, that Jesus took on flesh and that he lived the perfect life that we could never live and that he died for our sins, that he rose again from the grave on the third day, and he vanquished the kingdom of darkness by triumphing over his enemies and putting them to open shame. As people who are united to Jesus, we're called to take part in his victory. It's not just Jesus' victory, it's our victory too. So with that in mind, let's tell our families the Christian history and meaning behind Halloween. Let's dress up. Let's mock the enemy. Let's sing in precatory psalms. Psalm 2 is a good one. Let's remember the great cloud of witnesses made up of the saints that have passed on into the unseen realm before us. And let's model hospitality to our neighbors. And let's invite them into this Christian celebration too. Let's be Christians that do what Christians have always done for centuries, which is take ground for the kingdom of God.